This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Cincinnati City Council will appoint another new member following the resignation of Tamaya Denard, who is now facing federal bribery charges. She denies them. We start the weekly news review with WKRC-TV reporter Anjanette Levy. Anjanette, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have with us Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Byron McCauley. Byron, welcome back.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you want to join us. I'll say that one more time, 513-419-7100. And Jeanette, let's just start with you on some nuts and bolts here. Former now Councilwoman Denard has stepped down, but we also had some strange development this week involving a car that was registered to her, reported stolen, and then ultimately crashing into a home in East Walnut Hills. This story was already rather shocking for someone that the community had gotten to know over the past few years, but help us understand what exactly went down with this car.
Well, apparently, she lives over in the, Mount Adams area, I'll say. I don't want to put out where anybody really lives. But she reported this vehicle stolen. It's a vehicle that belongs, it's in her mother's name, but it's my understanding she had been driving this vehicle around for quite a while. It was a Lexus. Tamaya Denard had reported it stolen, and then two men, crashed this car early Monday morning. And I know I did some, little bit of research on Court Clerk, looking those men up, and they both have records, one for trafficking in cocaine, another for aggravated – another's on a no-R bond right now, actually, for aggravated drug possession. So pretty interesting. It kind of makes you think, like, what in the world is going on? That seems like a really unlucky streak. How many times can lightning strike one person in a matter of a couple of weeks? So I don't know that there's more to the story, but, my reporter antenna obviously was up, and I think there probably is more to that we're going to learn.
But we don't know officially whether there's any connection between the former
officially
councilman and these two guys.
But it is awfully coincidental that, a vehicle that she had been driving, parked at her apartment building, vanishes and ends up in the hands of two men, with some drug convictions on their records. One of them has done quite a bit of time in prison for selling drugs.
What's the last we've heard from Tamaya Denard publicly?
The last we really heard was earlier this week when she put out that statement resigning, announcing her resignation. And really, I think that it forced her hand when Joe Dieters on Sunday spoke with the Inquirer first, and then we spoke with him by phone. He was out of town, and he said, look, if she doesn't resign, I'm going to the grand jury Tuesday morning. I will file a state bribery charge against her, and I will seek to have her suspended. And I think that really forced her hand, because if he would have done that, and the suspension would have progressed through the Ohio Supreme Court, guess who appoints her successor? It's not P.G. Sittenfeld, whom she designated when she took office. It's Judge Ralph Winkler, the probate court judge here in Hamilton County, who obviously, is endorsed by the Republican Party. So I think she had a decision to make. I don't know if there was political pressure there, but I can't imagine that there wasn't. So now she resigned, and P.G. Sittenfeld gets to pick her successor.
Because the way the council operates, if you're leaving council, you do have the opportunity to designate
right
who will select your successor. And that's what happened here. And we had not heard originally a lot from other members of council until it looked like the evidence was starting to be quite damning.
Yeah. And I as a reporter, you always want your question answered. I don't ask a question wanting a roundabout answer. And we asked those council members. I asked P.G. Sittenfeld straight up, I put it on my Facebook page, the clip, and I said, should she step down? And he said, I can repeat what I just said, that I think that, there's going to be a decision soon. And I'm like, that's not what I asked you. Yes or no, should she step down? Because I think they were trying to, they all had this due process line that they were talking about. And of course, due process, everybody is entitled to that under the Constitution, through the courts. But we are talking about an elected official accused of bribery. There are text messages and apparently recordings. And of course, she is entitled to all of the fairness, and all of her rights under the Constitution. But that's a really serious allegation, and to be conducting the people's business down at City Hall under that cloud would be very difficult. And they wouldn't, you know, David Mann, I think, was the only one that came out and said, I think that she needs to be suspended. And then Mayor Cranley said if she can't prove she's actually innocent, she needs to step down. So everybody else kind of hemmed and hawed about it a little bit.
Byron McCauley is a columnist with the Cincinnati Inquirer and is also with us. And Byron, I imagine that the cloud of the Gang of Five issue, with five members of the council, including former Councilwoman Dinard and some others that we've mentioned, had been privately text messaging each other. It was ultimately determined to be a quorum of the council meeting illegally. I imagine that cloud was hanging over some of them as they weighed what they could say with any degree of righteousness about Councilwoman Dinard's accusations.
Absolutely. You know, it's really tough when you yourself you've been found or you admitted guilt in this text messaging scandal, which the Gang of Five, which included Tamaya Dinard, by the way, had done. So when it's time to look at your colleague and you're hearing and you're seeing the text messages and people are asking you, reporters, which, you know, media does what it does best in these situations, which they want answers. We want answers. And so when you have a collection of folks asking you, what should your colleague do? Well, how do you manage this righteous indignation when you yourself have been accused and not found guilty, but when you admitted to wrongdoing yourself? So that was a tough situation, I think, for the council members. But I think ultimately, the more that the evidence, the apparent evidence that is building up in this case starts to show itself, you know, you can get a little bit more courageous the more facts you have and sort of the snowball effect, right? Everybody, once one person, you know, comes out and declares it, you know, Tamaya should step down, then, you know, it makes it a little bit easier.
We should know, of course, that the rule of law would not equate the violation of the Sunshine Law with the very serious federal charges that could result in prison time for Tamaya Dinard.
Correct.
But the court of public opinion is different than the court of law. And some of these folks have political futures still, particularly Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld, who has his eye apparently on the mayor's seat. And Jeanette Levy here from Local 12 mentioned David Mann, also on the council, is already exploring apparently a run for mayor. It could be those two against each other. Mm-hmm. So those considerations, I imagine, have to be taken into account as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have people sitting on the council who, you know, they want to be mayor and they've declared they want to be mayor. With this situation, though, and Anjanette mentioned this, you know, you have to have due process. Tamaya Dinard, doesn't look great for her right now based on the information that we have right now. But you do have to have due process. She still has to, you know, be indicted, and we have to see what the charges are going to be. But one of the things that I tried to do, and I felt that it was interesting to do, as I said earlier, reporters, when we see a story like this, our response is to get as much information as possible because it's got all the great elements. But I wanted to take a little bit of a step back in a column that I wrote and sort of talk about the human side that I knew about Tamaya Dinard.
You referred to her, at least in the headline. I don't know if you wrote the headline, but certainly one of the editors did, and it was mm-hmm. published this way. Tamaya Dinard, at once an inspiring and a tragic figure.
Right. Yeah, that headline, I think, sort of sums up that column. When I first met Tamaya, and this was several years ago, probably four years ago, you know, as I described her in the column, you know, she is the same person who's accused of these criminal activity is also a person who was inspiring to young women who might be aspire to be politicians like her one day. Her personality and her, you know, she had sort of this bubbly effect, I would say, on people. Everyone knew her. You know, she sort of makes the rounds. She was really a person that you thought, okay, this person is going to be going places because just the way she kind of carries herself and the way she entered politics.
I think she also, can I add to that?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Because she really did have a lot of potential, and maybe she'll still be able to reach that potential someday, mm-hmm. but it seems unlikely at this point. But she did have kind of like a great like presence about her, like mm-hmm. her smile and things like that. She
exactly.
could be very engaging and things mm-hmm. like that. But I know obviously she rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
Right.
with some of the comments she's made over the last year or two.
Right.
But she did. She was an engaging person.
She was engaging. And the fact that she, you know, her backstory was compelling as well. You know, that's one of the when you are a star, sometimes, you know, when the light is very hot on you and the fall is greater. And I think she was ascending. And this, unfortunately, has really sidetracked her with her her career. So we don't know where she's going to do and where this case is going to go. But I think it's really tragic when I talk about her being a tragic figure and at once inspiring. You know, I had very mixed emotions about it. Don't condone that activity. You know, I like high integrity public officials representing me. And so when this happened, you know, it kind of threw a lot of us a little bit of a curveball.
You wrote, Byron, that there is a roadmap to restoration. And you talked about how both of the parties on there, on the council, can make amends.
I did. So when I wrote that, what I was thinking of, most people, when they're around their kitchen table talking about city council, one of the first things that they say is they're not getting along. They're always arguing. You know, they're not getting anything done. And so I wanted to say, hey, let's back up. Remember your oath of office and even go one better and just publicly declare, you know, we're going to operate and we're going to do the public's business with integrity, et cetera, and really sort of give the public an opportunity to see you striving to do your best for them. Like, that's what we need as voters, as people who live in this city, who want to see the city grow and prosper. Now we have a series of black eyes, the Gang of Five, and then you have Tamaya Denard. I mentioned both parties because I think both should come together and be more collaborative. So,
you've got a couple of things that are underway here, right? So you had Councilwoman Amy Murray, who was term limited and would not be seeking office again, stepping down to take a role in the Trump administration. So her seat is being filled in a similar manner. Her designated person chose Betsy Sunderman,
yes,
who was a judge here in the county, mm-hmm, and will take her
magistrate
spot on
the
council, a magistrate.
Absolutely.
And now you've got another new council member who will be joining. And then next time around, following the election, because so many are term limited or maybe they're seeking the mayor's seat, the whole council will look differently. So let me bring Anjanette back in. This is what are you hearing from people in terms of what they want to see from their government? I imagine that this must offer an opportunity for people to lose faith in council when this type of stuff is happening.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because I think a lot of people have already lost faith in Plum Street. And it was before this even happened. I think this was kind of like, you know, the cherry on top was the Tamaya Denard arrest. I think the Gang of Five stuff and some of the things that go on at council, I think that a lot of people are like, you know what? And I think Howard Wilkinson even said it was like the most embarrassing thing he's ever seen in all his years of covering City Hall. I think that a lot of people have already lost faith and they've kind of given up on this council. I've talked to people who told me they were approached about possibly throwing their name in the hat for this, for Tamaya's seat. And they were like, no way. You don't put my name anywhere near that. I want nothing to do with these people. And I was like, oh, boy, whoa. That tells you a lot right there. If somebody's not willing to put their name in for consideration because they just don't want anything to do with this. So I think that they can really turn the page. I think that they all have an obligation and a duty, no matter their party, to lead and do what's right for the people and put the politics aside for now.
Okay, we've got 30 seconds. Who ends up getting this seat, do we think? Are you allowed to speculate?
Well, you know, I did speculate in that column. There are several names being thrown out there. Michelle Dillingham, who was the 10th place vote getter, Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, who her name has been tossed out there a good bit, and so high integrity people. I wouldn't venture to say who might get it, but those are some high integrity people who really could represent the city well.
Mm-hmm. I'm not really supposed to speculate, although I would love to.
Yeah. Well, we'll let you off
You're the
hook,
columnist
then.
Here.
Right.
But
right.
I don't know if I see, just with the way the Democratic Party is going right now, especially like with city politics, I could see the party and P.G. Sittenfeld wanting an African-American woman to fill that seat. So I don't know if I think that Michelle Dillingham is going to get it. I know she's kind of campaigning for it.
She is.
But who knows? I mean, there could be somebody else out there floating around that could be a great candidate. You know, Jan Michelle Kearney would be probably a really good person to fill that seat. Her husband, you know, possibly considering a run for mayor himself. So could be interesting.
We'll have to wait and see. Anjanette Levy from WKRC-TV and Byron McCauley, the Cincinnati Inquirer columnist. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
The News Review continues after this. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The weekly news review continues now with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Andy, good Friday.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
We're doing well. So we want to talk about coronavirus. And first things first, there was this huge, huge Arnold event that was taking place that was severely impacted by people's concern over coronavirus. We talked a little bit about it on Thursday with Governor DeWine about his feelings about it. But for our listeners' sake, again, tell us what went down here.
Sure. So just as a reminder, the Arnold Sports Festival is this very, very big event here in Columbus. It's been here for decades now. It brings in more than 200,000 people from not only around Ohio, not only from around the Midwest, but the entire world. More than 80 different people from more than 80 different countries reportedly come here every year, or were supposed to this year. And there are also 22,000 athletes that participate in all sorts of different competitions throughout the weekend. That's powerlifting, bodybuilding, physique competitions, even disc golf and martial arts. So there's just all sorts of things. It's a multi-sports event. And with all that and with all the pomp and circumstance came a real risk in the eyes of Governor Mike DeWine and Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther and former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. They all decided this past Tuesday that the giant expo that happens every year during the festival, that's a trade show, that would be canceled and that spectators would not be allowed to attend the competitions. So the athletes who have been spending all year working up to this moment can still compete, but they were not going to have large gatherings of people coming around to be spectators. Then a couple of things went back and forth. Governor Schwarzenegger basically reversed course and flipped on his decision to agree to no spectators. And so then the DeWine administration had to step in and say, no, 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 we had a deal, and issued a public health order. So spectators are still not allowed to go to the festival. And we can talk about all sorts of reasons of why that's important. You know, what they're seeing right now, state officials are trying to, mitigate the risk as much as possible at this point when it comes to the potential spread of coronavirus, which it's important to make sure we always say a couple of different things. One, there are no confirmed cases of coronavirus in Ohio or of COVID-19 in Ohio right now. And as much as there's this balance here. Nobody wants to panic or create fear or panic, but state officials have been saying it is important to be prepared.
Okay, so what's different about this event, the Arnold, when compared to others? I mean, it's basketball season, right? So it's also playoff season for high school and college basketball, and you imagine crowds are going to be showing up for those games. Why go to one of those games but not to the Arnold?
So to understand this from the state perspective, I think it's important to understand the pathology of a virus or the how epidemiologists sort of track the path of a virus. And so in the case of a basketball game, like you just mentioned, state officials or public officials sort of see this as a contained event where if I have a ticket to a basketball game, And then if I, for some reason, have a confirmed case of COVID-19, then epidemiologists or these disease detectives can say, okay, Andy sat in this chair, in this row, and had contact with about this many people. And they're able to track that and be able to track the exposure of that potential virus. For something like the Arnold Sports Festival, public officials were saying, well, it's just too difficult to track. When you get a ticket, it's a general admission ticket, and you kind of float from one event to another, and there's just no telling. There's no way of really being able to pinpoint the exposure to a virus in an event like that. Other concerns included just the fact that people from 80 different countries were all going to be in one enclosed space. And then the third concern was that the Columbus Public of Health came to the state saying, listen, we've reviewed this. We've tried to create a response plan. We looked at what the Arnold people were doing with their response plan. And we think we need more help with this.
Your colleague Karen Kassler reported that three people are under investigation for coronavirus, though there are no confirmed cases in the state. As you mentioned earlier, 255 people, Karen reported, are or have been at one point in self-quarantine. And we know that on Thursday, the governor called a lot of county-level health officials to the Capitol to discuss preparedness and response possibilities. Did we learn anything on Thursday from that?
Yeah, there's all sorts of things that were learned in that summit. One, I think the most important thing in the viewpoint of the state of Ohio and from Governor DeWine is they think that transparency is going to be a key component to all of this, to make sure that everybody is talking out loud to one another about what they're seeing, how they handled it, what the best practices were, and to share that information with one another, for everybody to be on the same page, basically from a top-down approach. And that's why you've been seeing DeWine at the forefront of this. That's why you've been seeing the Ohio Department of Health Director Amy Acton being at the forefront of this, because they're trying to say that, listen, we need to have transparency, we need to have open communication with each other, and we need to be doing as much as possible to sort of help prevent any sort of rising panic among people when it comes to this. And then the other thing is that the different public health departments from around the state that did have a potential case of coronavirus, they were able to talk about how they handled it, how they were able to do what's called contact tracing that we were talking earlier, and what they learned from it.
And again, citing your colleague Karen Kassler's reporting from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Dr. Amy Acton, the director of the Ohio Department of Health, said that so far this coronavirus COVID-19 situation appears to be similar to H1N1 or the swine flu pandemic that started in April of 2009 and lasted for 16 months. So we might be talking about this for a while.
Yeah, a lot of public health officials have been talking about this idea of, first of all, it should be noted that all the medical professionals believe from the state have been saying that a virus outbreak in Ohio, they believe, is imminent, that it will happen here. But what they've seen, like in the illnesses that you just listed off, is that if they're able to delay the spread of the virus for as long as possible, then that gives researchers more time to try to come up with the vaccine. That gives medical professionals more time to test out antivirals to be able to treat the illness. That gives hospitals and medical facilities more time to stock up on the equipment and resources that they need to be able to handle an influx in patients. So what we're seeing right now is, yes, they are similar to outbreaks that we've seen in the past. We've also are noticing in other states, unfortunately, that it's something that can hit really quickly, really hard, and really fast, and sort of spread and then linger for a long time. So the state's just trying to, as far as what they've been telling us, they were trying to prepare for all of that.
Andy Chow is a reporter with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Andy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The weekly news review continues now with a look at the state of the Democratic presidential primary. I spoke with WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson earlier in this pre-recorded conversation. And joining me now is WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Howard, always good to see you.
Good to see you, Michael.
So it's been quite a week. In fact, it's been like a month of a week, it feels like. The week has just been so long. And politically, I mean, you've been covering this for a long time. Have you
Is this unusual? Is this something that you've seen before? Yes. The type of dynamics that have transpired in the last several days in the presidential primary?
Not this quickly, where things are moving at the speed of light.
We've had comeback stories before.
Right.
I mean, even elections, sure. Bill Clinton, the comeback kid, John Kerry, New Hampshire.
Absolutely.
Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire.
But there were weeks between those comebacks. I mean, not, you know, days or hours or, you know, even minutes.
And of course, we're talking about the new comeback kid, and right. That's Joe Biden.
Joe Biden, of all people, yes.
Campaign declared dead, I mean, hardly a month ago, maybe just a couple weeks ago. He mm-hmm. had lost so poorly in Iowa, had lost so poorly in New Hampshire, did not do so well in Nevada. He was waiting all along for a big bounce out of South Carolina, and the bounce was so large that it bounced some of his primary rivals right out of the campaign.
Yes, that was the thing that I think, you know, he was obviously waiting for South Carolina to give him some momentum. And Jim Clyburn, you know, the congressman, when he endorsed Joe Biden, I think that had a major, major impact on the outcome of that election.
Jim Clyburn, of course, an African-American member of Congress, and Joe Biden had all along been waiting for a state to vote that had a large population of African-Americans. Right. That was going to be his firewall.
And that is South Carolina, particularly on the Democratic side.
So when you're headed to South Carolina, and really what he was hoping for was a win, right? He needed to change the narrative that he was a viable candidate. But I have to wonder if even his campaign expected the rout that he got there.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think they were looking at, you know, 25-30%, you know, over Bernie Sanders. If they had limped out of there with 5-10%, I think they would have been happy.
And so that happened in South Carolina. That was before Super Tuesday, which happened right. This week. So we have to talk a little bit about what South Carolina triggered. The other candidates in the race started to look at the math and started to consider their own paths forward. And primary candidates who may more align with Joe Biden in these little nuances within the Democratic wings decided that they didn't have a path forward and that they better jump out now because Joe's got the momentum. And so we're talking about Senator Amy Klobuchar and we're talking about former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. They appeared with him the day before Super Tuesday in Texas.
Right.
And have you ever seen in all of your years of covering politics, those types of candidacies send all of their supporters to Joe the way that they did?
No, it was just a stampede. I mean, it just started and wouldn't stop. And I don't know how much, you know, I talked to some of Mayor Pete's supporters and some of them said, well, we'll go with him for now. But, you know, others said, well, we're going to sit back and wait, see what happens. But, you know, if you sit back and wait to see what happens in this climate, you may be left behind. And I think most of them are going to go with Joe Biden. In places like Michigan, in places like Ohio, and the St. Patrick's Day primaries.
Right, which is, of course, the Buckeye State the included Buckeye in State. There. We want to talk a little bit about what could be at stake there. But here's what's happened since Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
More candidates are gone.
Right.
This is really a two-person race now for the Democratic nomination between yes. former Vice President Joe Biden, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, because Joe Biden thumped everyone just about in nearly every state on Super Tuesday. 14 states up for grabs in the territory of American Samoa. Michael Bloomberg won American
That's
Samoa.
Right. Yeah,
he
yeah.
did get a win.
Yes.
And Bernie Sanders won California, which was the biggest gift of the night. But he also won Utah and Colorado. And Bernie ran the table in all the other states, including Amy Klobuchar's native Minnesota,
yes.
including Elizabeth Warren's native Massachusetts, states where he had not even been considered viable just basically
hours before
Super Tuesday,
right.
won them all in many cases comfortable leads over Bernie Sanders. And so now Bloomberg's out and Elizabeth Warren followed him a couple of days later, dropping out of the race, clearing the field completely, except for Tulsi Gabbard, the congressional representative from Hawaii,
right.
who remains, you know, and she also ran, but
yeah.
Is technically still in the race. What happens now?
I don't know. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, Joe Biden a few week or so ago, they weren't talking about him winning Massachusetts. They were talking about Bernie knocking off Elizabeth Warren. Well, he Elizabeth Warren finished third in her own state. So she had absolutely no choice. I mean, there was no, you know, where could she go on the electoral map? So, you know, it came to a point where there's only two viable candidates, and it's going to be head to head, and it's going to be brutal, and it's going to be expensive, and there's going to be lots of money pouring into places like Ohio and like the Great Lakes states, like Florida, and the ones that are coming up over the next few weeks. That's what's going to decide it, I think. And there are certain advantages that Biden has in that the money is probably going to start flowing his way, because there's a whole lot. You saw what happened to the stock market as soon as Joe Biden did his 9-state sweep in Super Tuesday. Boom. It shot the future
somewhat weaponized against him, though, by both the candidate Sanders and his supporters, is that, well, look, healthcare company stocks went up when Joe Biden won, which represents he doesn't bring the change that we need.
Right.
But I don't know that resonates with a lot of people.
It's a good argument. It's a good argument to use, but it's a really difficult one to put into a 30-second TV commercial, or even in a sound bite.
How do
on
you
television.
Argue this candidate made the stock market go up? Right. Don't vote for
don't
him.
Don't vote for him. Right? Yeah, he made your 401k whole again. You know, it's just a very hard thing to explain to people. Even if you're right, even if it's your argument is correct, I just don't think it's going to fly.
Let's talk about Senator Elizabeth Warren's campaign, because this is the second presidential cycle in a row where a female politician, a woman, was able to be extremely competitive. Obviously, last time Hillary Clinton won the nomination for the Democratic Party, making history, but she didn't get to the White House. This Democratic primary had many women who were running. Some dropped out before votes were cast, like Senator Kamala Harris, as Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York. Others dropped out as the votes started being cast, including Senator Amy Klobuchar, and now Senator Elizabeth Warren, who at one point, prior to votes being cast, had been looked at as a front runner in this campaign, had a lot of money, a lot of organization, had a message that was resonating, I think, to a variety of different positions on the ideological spectrum on the left. But it didn't work out for her either. Can we talk specifically about her and then about women candidates in this country in general? First, what happened with Elizabeth Warren?
I think she just got eaten up by this Bernie movement that, you know, she had to peel away some of his vote. And she didn't do that. She didn't get any of the younger vote. She was doing very well among some women, like politically active women, but not the women of the suburban types who are just, you know, who are very interested in what the outcome of this election, but they're not the activist types. And she couldn't build her base out beyond the Democratic activist types, the women of the Democratic Party.
So I'm wondering about people who might be disappointed, just, you know, regardless of perspective or political feelings, but somebody who was like, it's time. We've never had a woman president. Right. Came close last time. And yet again, there's going to be another election cycle guaranteeing at least another 4 years of a man in the White House.
And this is supposed to be the year of the woman in American politics. Everybody said so. And every woman who has run so far this year has been forced out because they just haven't performed very well. I don't know if that's a function of the candidates or the atmosphere, but I would be very surprised whether Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden wins this nomination that they don't turn to one of those women. Amy Klobuchar, even Elizabeth Warren.
You expect a person on the ticket, a woman?
I would think so, and possibly a woman of color, a woman, African American woman. You know, there's one in Ohio who's being talked about as a potential running mate for Bernie Sanders, and that's Nina Turner, former state senator. She was one of the very early people to come out for Bernie Sanders in 2016. She's very forceful, very dynamic, a great speaker. And I've seen like the odds makers are giving her a lot of attention right now.
Instead, the race on both sides now is coming down to, it's not the year of the woman, it's the year of the old white guy. So Donald Trump is in his 70s. Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are in their late 70s. What does that say about the state of the electorate? You know, I read some analysis earlier that suggested that, look, people tend to vote towards candidates that are closer to their age, and Americans are aging, and older voters turn out. Is that just what's happening?
That's exactly what's happening, because older voters turn out. We've seen what happened on Super Tuesday. The youngest group of voters, the turnout wasn't very good in most states, and that hurt Bernie in a lot of places. And, you know, I mean, here's a 77 or soon to be 78-year-old man who has a devotion of 18 to 20-year-olds all over this country, and they don't seem to see any irony in that fact, you know, because they see him as the leader, the one who's going to lead us out of all of this.
I saw some further analysis that just offered up this little nugget. If Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, or Barack Obama, through some constitutional glitch, were able to jump into the race now, all three of them would be the youngest candidate.
Yes.
Among those who are remaining.
Exactly right. Yes. So, I mean, it's amazing, really.
But let's talk a little bit about that point that you were raising about Bernie Sanders and his youth voters, his younger voters. They did not turn up. And he gave an interview, a long, hour-long interview with MSNBC host Rachel Maddow this week.
Yes.
And he didn't seem cognizant of the fact that the message he's shouting is not accurate. He's not expanded the voter base, and he has not increased voter turnout. And he expressed surprise when Rachel Maddow raised that fact to him. He said, well, I haven't seen those numbers. The other scary number for him that I haven't heard talked about a whole lot is that, sure, he won Vermont on Super Tuesday. He got 50% of the vote there. When he was up against Hillary Clinton last time, he got more than 85% of the vote, only 50% in his home state. What's different about Bernie Sanders' campaign this time around? Did it plateau in 2016 and just floated into the same group of people this time around?
Everything in politics plateaus at some point or another and starts turning into something else. And I think in Bernie's case, it might be the beginning of that. That's why it's going to be very, very difficult for him in some of these upcoming primaries to get any kind of momentum going. I mean, he won in Michigan 4 years ago, but, you know,
it was a squeaker.
It was a squeaker. It was very close. And if he has that kind of a problem getting young voters out in a state like Michigan, then he can't win. Same thing goes for Ohio. Ohio tends to be an older voting population, a more conservative, more centrist, even on the Democratic side. And those people are going to vote. There is no question about it. They are going to vote. If you look now at the early voting numbers in Ohio, they're astronomical. So much more than any other year prior, or 2016, you know, was the last one where you had primaries on both sides.
I want to talk a little bit about what the candidates will be telling Ohio voters ahead of the primary here, which is just over a week and a half away. But before that, I'm also curious of your analysis about the difference in the race as it relates specifically to Bernie Sanders going up against Joe Biden instead of Hillary Clinton, because I look at states like Kentucky last time in the Democratic side and West Virginia, which Bernie won. It was very close in Kentucky, though Hillary won in 2016. You know, these are states that may have majority Democratic voters, but they tend to vote Republicans. And I'm wondering if a lot of them just saw an opportunity to vote against Hillary Clinton in those primaries last time. And now it's not as serious an issue for them.
Yeah, they did. Now, you know, there may have been some primary jumping to you know, kind of skew the results and places like that. But they don't want, you know, Joe Biden, I think they could live with. You know, he's somebody that they could relate to. He could go around in Kentucky, Eastern Kentucky, Western Kentucky. I don't care what part of it. He can relate to voters. You know, because he's got a great story to tell, and his own backstory is a great story to tell. And people empathize with it and believe, look at him and say, this guy really means what he says.
He's got to keep it together, though. He's had a hard time articulating his messages. There's just been a series of video after video of him saying things that, the language doesn't have the tightness that it used to have.
Yes.
You know, and he's an older man now.
Right.
And you're seeing some criticism, and maybe he's showing early signs of dementia. You see the same criticism of the president,
Trump,
and I certainly
yes.
don't mean to elevate those accusations.
Yes.
But he is slipping in terms of the way he speaks. It's different than how he used to speak. We learned a lot about his youth stuttering problem.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't heard a whole lot about that before. And so, I mean, whether that's amplified as sort of a counter to the way he's delivering his message, how close are people going to be watching Joe Biden in that respect?
I think they'll be watching him very closely. One thing I think they're going to see is, if you listen to him on Tuesday night, he was very together then. You know, he had his message right. He had nailed it. You know, this is what we're going to take to Donald Trump, and he's going to like it, and he's going to leave. And that was the old Joe. And I think he can still summon that, you know. But you're right; he does have a problem on a day-to-day basis. Now it's going to be extremely important in the debates, because that's a real opportunity for him.
Bernie wants the debate. He wants an hour-long debate on healthcare. He said that this week to Rachel Maddow and on social that he wants a full-on hour-long debate. What will those look like? Because we can probably anticipate there will be a debate with those two on stage.
I think so. Yeah. It's going to look like, I think, pretty much what Joe Biden said the other night. He said, look, we've got two candidates basically in this race, a socialist and a Democrat, and I'm the Democrat.
That has absolutely been his message going forward. He's capitalizing on people who want to come home to the Democratic Party, who aren't interested in revolution, who want to feel comfortable again.
Right. And as far as Obamacare is concerned, they like Obamacare. And they like many features of it, and they don't really – they're not quite sure about the idea of Medicare for all. What's it going to cost? You know, what's it going to do to me in terms of the physicians that I can see?
So we're going to see in states like Ohio, in states like Michigan, industrial Rust Belt states, the Sanders campaign going after Joe Biden on – issues like the old North America Free Trade Agreement.
Right.
Is that going to work this time? Are we too far away from that trade agreement now? Or will that resonate in some parts of the state?
It will resonate in some parts of the state. There's no question about that. Up in Toledo, it's still a very big issue. In Northeast Ohio and Mahoning Valley, it's still a big issue. And people are watching very closely to see what happens now with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada treaty. And that is a real issue, a real pocketbook issue that people in Ohio vote on. They really vote on those issues.
So what happens in Ohio? Who wins it?
I would think that Biden would, just because of the makeup of the Democratic electorate in Ohio and the people who will be going to the polls. And you take a whole big slice of the state where you have an older population, somewhat less educated population, but, you know, and a little bit more conservative, a little more, you know, towards the center or even towards the right. And I don't see them voting for Bernie's revolution.
After Ohio votes, we will have concluded votes in Florida and Michigan as well.
Right.
And there won't be many big prizes left. So if Biden is able to win Florida, Ohio, Michigan, is the race over at that point?
I would think that it certainly has the potential of being over by then if that happens, if he hits that trifecta.
Well, Ohio votes on March 17, and you'll be joining me in the studio on March 19 with our good buddy Ken Rudin for another edition of the Political Junkie. So there will be fewer candidates to talk about, but the same old four of us with Dr. Rachel Bloom as well Miami will be getting together. So Howard, WVXU senior political analyst, thank you for taking some time and talking about the state of the race.
Thank you.
And now back here live in the studio at WVXU with me is Tana Weingartner, our very own Tana Weingartner. Hi, Tana. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could be here to wrap up the weekly news review. You had a really great story this week. It's about Wikipedia. And we as journalists are told to kind of stay away from that, but this was a cool story.
But Wikipedia is, you know, everyone's sort of first stop. It comes up tops usually when you Google whatever you're Googling. But and it's long had a quote-unquote male problem. Most of the profiles about people are about men. Most of the people that author them are men. So there's a lot of groups that are working to change that. Women in Red is one of the most popular ones that works on getting some of that systemic bias out. And at Earlham College in Richmond, there's a professor there who's working with her students to identify profiles, high-profile women, scientists, scholars, people that should be on Wikipedia but aren't. So they're identifying these women, they're writing the profiles and getting them published and getting them on kind of the go-to page on Wikipedia for it as well.
Did they talk about why this is important?
Well, yeah. I mean, women are doing great things, they said, and they deserve to be recognized for it. I mean, it is sort of like a duh question, but one that should be asked.
For sure. So anytime that if there's one of these women that they identify as worthy of having their own Wikipedia page, if you were to do a Google search for this person and there was no Wikipedia page to show up, this now solves that problem, right? And what's great about Wikipedia, from my perspective, is that, it's edited by users, so it can be misleading. But often, because it's also policed by users, there are citations at the bottom that can lead you to other places.
Right. And so the professor made sure to point out, because often profiles of women are more highly reported for deletion. They're submitted more often to be deleted. So she said they're making sure that all the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted, everything is cited, so that they have that paper trail so that they won't get taken down.
This sounds like a pretty daunting project, finding all of the women who would be
they're just doing it one at a time. They've had 10 up so far. They're hoping to do more. They're expanding. They originally started just in the psychology area because that's what this professor teaches, but they are expanding out to other areas.
Okay.
So yeah, she said the list is infinite.
My goodness, a lot of work for these college students. Yeah. And hey, before we let you go, I know you talked to some people at the Newport Aquarium because they announced another unique exhibit coming up.
Yeah, their shipwreck exhibit just opened today, and it has lots of eels, which, aren't necessarily, they get a bad rap. They're mysterious in their attack, and they have big, sharp teeth, but they're actually kind of soft skin, so they're really susceptible to other animals. But they have lots of different kinds of eels in this exhibit. If you go, I recommend the garden eels. Do you remember Slimy, Oscar the Grouch's friend from Sesame Street? He's like a little worm.
Yeah, I do.
Okay,
I didn't know he had a name.
Yeah, his name is Slimy. So they look kind of like Slimy, and they burrow in the sand, and they kind of stick their little heads up and look around. They look kind of like snakes, honestly. But the longer you look at them, the cuter they are.
It takes a while. They're an acquired taste. But there's a variety of eels to check out.
Uh-huh.
And so I imagine that this shipwreck theme involves some sort of decor that indicates
There's a pirate treasure. There's the captain's quarters. You can get your picture taken at the steering wheel, the helm.
How close can you get to the eels?
I mean, they're on the other side of the glass.
Okay, so they are enclosed, right?
Yes, you cannot touch them.
Okay, that's good to know. Maybe I will check them out. Okay, that was WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. Someday you'll be reading about her on Wikipedia, I imagine.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Thanks for being here, Tana.
You're welcome.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.